This is 1A. I'm Celeste Headley in Washington, in for Joshua Johnson. Military officials in Iran have confirmed that the country's armed forces shot down a U.S. military drone. They say the aircraft violated Iranian airspace. The U.S. military, though, says the unmanned surveillance drone was flying over international waters when it was shot down, and they describe the incident as an unprovoked attack. Last week, the U.S. accused Iran of attacking two oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman. Iran denies those allegations. And all of this comes amid ratcheting tensions and concerns over Iran's stockpile of low-enriched uranium. Let's welcome back to 1A of Vali Nasser. He's dean of the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies and a former senior administration advisor under President Barack Obama. Vali, it's great to see you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I'm sure this can be very confusing to people who are watching it as civilians, one might say, and not really following this through. So we could we maybe start with a recent timeline of the things that have led us here, because back in, well, if you go back to 2018, that's when President Trump walked away from the Iran nuclear deal and started reinstating sanctions. But maybe just this year, going back to when four oil tankers were damaged by explosions, and there was accusations then that Iran was maybe behind that. What's brought us here?
So let's go a little bit further back to May, which is when President Trump announced that he was going to remove all the exemptions he had given to countries that were still buying Iranian oil. The U.S. had allowed some countries to continue to buy oil, that he was going to remove those exemptions and that he was going to take Iran's oil exports to zero. In other words, completely strangle the Iranian economy. And then the United States proceeded to designate the Revolutionary Guards, the IRGC, as a foreign terrorist organization. So this was a major ratcheting up of pressure And also
threat. That's what he calls his approach, right? Maximum pressure?
Maximum pressure. And also, I think the Iranians also construed this, that, look, they've arrived at the end game. He's going to completely crush their economy. They believe that he actually wants regime change, not just talks. And they look at his national security advisor, his secretary of state, and they're convinced that their intention is to break the Iranian state. So the Iranians, I think, began to see that just sitting silently and being pressured to death is not going to work. And they've now began to push back. So their strategy is to meet maximum pressure with maximum resistance and to up the ante on the U.S., basically saying that, look, we're willing to risk war. We're willing to escalate. And we're not just going to sit here for you to apply maximum pressure on us.
Okay. So what we have today was a shooting down of a U.S. drone. It was a surveillance drone. It's technically an RQ-4A Global Hawk. What was it doing there?
Well, probably it's gathering information on Iran. The United States wants to know troop movements in Iran. It wants to know where Iranian missiles are positioned. It's monitoring nuclear activity. It's monitoring what the Iranians are doing. So it's intelligence gathering.
Since you mentioned nuclear activity, let's talk about this announcement. Iran announced that its stockpile of low-enriched uranium has increased beyond the point they're supposed to have. Mm-hmm. That's not the only thing they've said. It sounds almost like a threat that they want these sanctions. They want their economy to be able to rebound, or they'll break the deal. Is that fair?
That's right. In other words, first of all, they're saying that, look, we've waited for 2 years for the Europeans, Chinese, and the Russians to give us economic benefits that they think they are owed to under the nuclear deal. They haven't got anything, so they're following a policy of less for less. You know, as if we're going to get less economic benefits, you're going to get less nuclear compliance. But, you know, in a way, if Iran wants to get Trump's attention, if he wants to say that maximum pressure is risky and Trump better think twice about it, one thing they're doing is escalating in the Persian Gulf, hitting tankers, hitting drones. The other thing is to say, well, look, we can go nuclear. We can take our program underground. We can actually get out of the nuclear deal. And we can take the situation to a much worse place than when President Obama tried to bring about a nuclear deal.
So part of the Trump administration's line has been maximum pressure will allow Trump to negotiate a stronger nuclear deal. NPR spoke to U.S. Special Representative for Iran, Brian Hook, yesterday, and he reemphasized he thought pulling out of the Iran deal was a good idea.
We left the deal about over a year ago, And that has put us into the position that we're in today, that has allowed us to run a campaign of economic pressure with the goal of both denying this regime the revenue that it needs to run an expansionist and violent foreign policy, but it also is designed to bring Iran back to the negotiating table. If you look at the 40-year history of this regime, they don't come back to the table absent pressure. And we've put in place a foreign policy that has denied this regime tens of billions of dollars in revenue, and that is having a positive effect in the region.
A positive effect. What do you think are the chances that U.S. pressure in ratcheting up the pressure like this will bring Iran back to the table? And maybe that's going on already behind closed doors?
Possibly. But I think the pressure has got Iran's attention. They may be willing to come to the table. But also they're trying to get leverage of their own. And they're also saying that they're not going to just surrender. So I think from here on, the U.S. also should have a diplomatic strategy if it wants maximum pressure to get somewhere. I mean, President Obama started with pressure on Iran, but he had a diplomatic strategy about how do you go from pressure to the table. I think part of the problem is that the Iranians don't believe what Brian Hook is saying. They don't believe that the aim of maximum pressure is talks. They look at John Bolton and they say the aim of maximum pressure is just to crush us. And if that's the case, then we're going to fight back.
John Bolton is the national security advisor. We got a tweet from the president at 10:15 a.m. who said Iran made a very big mistake. I'm not going to ask you to interpret what that means. But I will say that the Iran's Revolutionary Guard said they wanted to send a clear message by shooting down that drone. And quote, the downing of the American drone was a clear message to America. The message is this. Those who defend the borders of the Islamic nation of Iran will react in a total and decisive way to any intrusions by foreign elements on our land. Our borders are our red line. End quote. What does that mean?
Well, that's basically saying that this was a defensive measure and that if America's thinking about war, we're going to defend ourselves. But I think the larger issue is that the hardliners, the Revolutionary Guard, believe that negotiating the nuclear deal and then staying silent in the face of maximum pressure has only led to greater American aggression because Washington thinks Iran is weak and will not respond. They think that the only way that you're going to get maximum pressure abating a bit and get the United States to back off is by being aggressive.
But the nuclear deal is still in effect with other nations, even if the U.S. pulled out. So what happens after this announcement by Iran about their increasing stockpile of low-enriched uranium?
Well, look, the nuclear deal is in effect because Iran has stayed in it.
Yeah.
In fact, Europeans, Chinese, and the Russians are not doing what they promised under the deal, which is to do business with Iran, to do economic trade. So this deal is being basically kept alive by Iran, and Iran is beginning to say that, look, we're not committed to it either. If you're not committed to making it work, we're not committed either. And Europe, China, Russia, and America, you're the ones who have to worry about keeping this alive, not us. I think that's the message they're sending.
Vali Nasser is the dean of the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. He's stepping down at the end of this month. More with him in a moment. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Home Instead Senior Care. Here is Lakeland Hogan, Home Instead gerontologist and caregiver advocate, reflecting on the importance of meaningful connections for seniors.
We know that connection is so important as we age, and that's really something that we've seen over the last 25 years. You know, it's much more than just providing care. It's building that relationship, helping to truly enhance their lives.
To learn more about Home Instead Senior Care's mission to enhance the lives of aging adults and their families, go to homeinstead.com.
When you're paying for college on your own, there's a lot to balance. To help you get through it all, NPR's Life Kit talked to the real experts, students.
Finding a side hustle that works for you and works for your schedule is hugely beneficial.
Find Life Kit's new guide on how to pay for college in Apple Podcasts or at npr.org/lifekit.
Back now to our conversation with Vali Nasser, an expert on Iran and former senior Obama administration advisor. Okay, so the U.S. has announced it's going to send 1,000 extra troops to the Persian Gulf region. It had already sent an aircraft carrier, a strike group, and B-52 bombers as well. How large is the military presence that the U.S. has in the Persian Gulf area now?
Well, it's not large enough to deal with a wider conflict with Iran. It's large enough to carry out maybe missile attacks on Iran or bombing campaigns, or to protect tankers or protect facilities. But if this continues, if maximum pressures bring maximum resistance from Iran, then the U.S. has to think about a much wider conflict with Iran, which means that it needs many, many more troops in the region, which is something President Trump has said he doesn't want to do. So in a way, the Iranians are calling Trump's bluff, that if you really don't want to go to war, if you don't want to put hundreds of thousands of troops and trillions of dollars into another war in the region, you better think of a different strategy than just applying pressure.
And as with anything else in that region and probably elsewhere, we're not dealing with just two parties, right? We have accusations. The Houthi rebels shot down a craft over Yemen using surface-to-air missiles. CENTCOM said that was enabled by Iranian assistance. And Saudi Arabia said just last week that the Houthi rebels fired a rocket targeting a plant within Saudi Arabia. So what is happening with all of the Iran's allies and connections in the entire region?
So first of all, those allies and proxies are part of Iran's, if you would, military capability. So it's not just troops or soldiers inside Iranian territory that the United States
meaning
has to
if we end up in a conflict, we're not dealing just with Iran.
That's what we're not dealing just with Iran inside its territory. We're dealing with all of Iran's allies in the region. But a lot of these allies also have interests of their own. And they think if Iran loses or if Iran folds its tent in the region, they will be minced meat as well. So they basically have strategies of their own. I mean, at the end of the day, the Houthis are fighting in Yemen, not just because Iran told them to fight. They have an agenda in Yemen. And they don't want to lose that war. The Hezbollah doesn't want to give up Lebanon. They're Lebanese. I mean, they're people of that origin. They have an interest. They're going to live in Lebanon going on. Iraq is the same. So those allies and proxies are also gearing up for a longer conflict within their own territories. But at the same time, they also would be taking direct orders from Tehran if a particular attack comes to be materialized.
Sort of the specter that we have not mentioned the word war, really. And that's what a lot of people are wondering. Does this mean we are leading to a war in Iran? Asking you to project here, realizing there's complications we don't know about, what do you think? Trump says he doesn't want war. Iran's government says they don't want war. But could it happen?
It could happen. First of all, you could have an accident, or you could have one side or the other overestimate its own capabilities.
An accident, accidentally.
Accidentally, you hit a target. You didn't mean to. Someone else may shoot a rocket at an American facility.
A drone goes missing, like they did in Afghanistan.
Exactly. And also miscalculation. In other words, you say, well, look, we can hit a drone and the U.S. is not going to respond, and U.S. will respond. Or the U.S. assumes that we're going to do this and the Iranians are going to go back in their hole and they're not going to respond, and the Iranians respond. So once it's kind of like what happened at the beginning of World War One, once both sides begin mobilizing, then sort of military confrontation becomes much more likely, just because everybody's geared up to go to war. And that's where the danger is. Unless there is a diplomatic off-ramp pretty quickly.
Pretty quickly.
Meaning we're talking about a month. We're talking shorter than that.
That's very quick.
But we've come around right now to the edge of where it is. I mean, first of all, Iran will not basically be able to survive on 200,000 barrels of oil or zero barrels of oil. I mean, so their anxiety and their desire to break the sanctions chokehold becomes more and more the way we go forward. And then every time they do something, the pressure for a U.S. reaction grows. And so first President Trump can say something in tweet, but pretty soon he's going to feel compelled to do something. And then that something may bring an Iranian reaction, and then he will have to react. And before you know it, both sides will get themselves in a place that they didn't intend to be. So threats And signals can very quickly become something much bigger. And I think that's where the danger is, that both sides may think this is going to be limited, and it doesn't end up being limited.
So we're talking about the Strait of Hormuz. A quarter of the world's oil passes through that waterway. Both nations that produce oil, besides Iran, and nations that buy oil, which is almost all of them, are obviously very concerned about what's going on. And we have seen that Iran is willing to talk to other nations, right? The Prime Minister of Japan recently visited. We don't know what was said. But what is the possibility that the diplomacy could come from somewhere outside the borders of the U.S.?
Well, it has to. I mean, there needs to be some intermediary that at least would negotiate some basics before the two can come to the table. I think the U.S. expects Iran to do some things, release some prisoners, show some kind of a sign that it's backing off somewhere, and the Iranians want some sanctions relief. In other words, they're just not going to show up at a meeting or one of them calls somebody else. So somebody like the president of Switzerland who came and visited Trump and carried a message, or the prime minister of Japan, would have to do that. And in the case of North Korea, it was the South Koreans who played that role. There was some messaging going back and forth, and then that paved the way for the first summit between Trump and Kim Jong-un. So I don't know whether we're going to get there, because we don't have a South Korea in the region, somebody who actually wants things to work out of that stature. But ultimately, I think if even Tehran and Washington do want to talk, they need somebody to negotiate rules of the game between them.
And do you have any recommendation on who might be? I mean, the UK is trying to find a new prime minister at the moment, so that's difficult.
No, I don't think the Europeans, and particularly United Kingdom, have any credibility with Iran. I think the Japanese, for instance, that Abe may get reengaged again if there is an actual path
Shinzo
forward.
Abe, the prime minister of Japan. Clearly, there's going to be developments that you will be watching closely, and others will be watching closely as well, to see if those conflicts continue to escalate, and NPR will be watching as well. Do you have any, like, brief advice for the president?
I would say he needs to think hard. If he doesn't want to go to war, what is the off-ramp? I mean, he has to take diplomacy seriously, and his own team is not capable of it. And doesn't have credibility. I mean, John Bolton or Secretary Pompeo are much more hardline than he is, and I don't think they are the ones who would lead this. So he has to actually find a way to build a diplomatic channel, at least.
Vali Nasser is the dean of the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies and a former senior Obama administration advisor. Vali, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This conversation was produced by Lindsay Foster-Thomas and edited by Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Celeste Headlee. We'll see you tomorrow for the Friday News Roundup. This is 1A.
In the Trump era, the news moves faster than ever, and the NPR Politics podcast is here to keep you informed. Every time there's a major political story, we get our best correspondents together to sort through the noise. The NPR Politics podcast, what you need to know right when it happens.